I'm back. This is Dr. Diana Wiley. I'm your host of Love, Lust, and Laughter. And I'm so happy to be again with Ross Rosenberg. Welcome back to the program, Ross.
So nice to be back on the show.
Of course, you've been on this program as recently as August and before that in April.
Mm-hmm.
So you are a psychotherapist and the author of The Human Magnet Syndrome, Why We Love People Who Hurt Us, Emotional Manipulators, Codependence, and Dysfunctional Relationships. And you're working on a new book. And we'll be talking some about that because what we're going to talk about on the program today is some of what you've been putting together, some from the old book, right, and
mm-hmm.
putting together some new materials for your new book.
Yep.
But let's catch people up. So what is the human magnet syndrome, and how come people repeat dysfunctional relationship patterns?
Well, you know, my book, The Human Magnet Syndrome, Why We Love People That Hurt Us, was written, or at least the idea of it was written to help me understand why I kept falling for these beautiful, wonderful, sweet, kind, giving women who
mm-hmm.
seemed just so perfect in the beginning, but after a while turned into these horrible, harmful narcissists. So,
and so
what I tried to figure out and eventually wrote in my book is a pattern that is repeated over and over again by so many people. The giving, altruistic, patient, codependent
mm-hmm.
seems to always be destined to fall in love with a certain type of person, and that is the pathological narcissist, the
mm-hmm.
person that
mm-hmm.
needs to be cared for and that needs to be taken care of. And it's like a dance. It's like a perfectly coordinated dance of a person that fits with another person. The caregiver fits with the care needer, and that is what the book talks about, is why we fall in love with the same type of dysfunctional or harmful person over and over again. Like a magnet, the north side is always
mm-hmm.
attracted to the south side, the codependent and the narcissist.
Yeah. And so writing this book and figuring all of this out, of course, you'd spend some time doing it before you actually put it to writing, but it helped you get into a really healthy marriage. Can you talk a little bit about that, Ross?
Yeah, you know, it was before I wrote the book, I was really ashamed of the fact that I'd been married. Actually, I'd been divorced twice,
mm-hmm.
ultimately married three times because, you know, as a psychotherapist, you know, I didn't want people to know that because I didn't want them to cast judgment upon me.
Mm-hmm.
But then I found that in my own healing and my own healing and recovery journey is I needed to, like, talk openly about it because there were so many other people that had that shameful secret.
Yeah.
And so what I do in my book and my trainings is I give people hope by explaining to them, put into words, why this pattern happens over and over again. And for me, I had to finally do my own work, my own healing, to rid myself of my dysfunctional patterns and meet the person who would become my soulmate.
Mm-hmm.
And
you've got her, and she's your wife now, right?
Oh, she's lovely. But my dad used to make this joke.
Uh-huh.
When I was young, he used to say, you know, Ross, what starts off as a soulmate ends up as a cellmate.
His cellmate.
And I found that, I mean, I remember that surprisingly ever since I was a teenager. And when I was writing my book, I recalled that. And that exactly is what happens with the human magnet syndrome.
Mm-hmm.
That beautiful feeling of knowing someone and feeling connected.
Mm-hmm.
It happened to me twice. I mean, and I hope to help other people break that habit, change that pattern, and find their soulmate. Who is their soulmate? Not someone that brings them down and hurts them.
Exactly. You mentioned the word hope. You give people hope. I've just come from a long weekend conference given by Michelle Weiner Davis.
Mm-hmm.
She has a number of books that are bestsellers, but she focused for this conference on her two of her best-selling books, Divorce Busting and The Sex-Starved Marriage. And she said that the therapist needs, the number one thing is, the therapist needs to give their clients hope.
Absolutely.
And and you bring yourself, and in your case, it sounds like you did the personal work, but you bring yourself to these clients. You're sitting in front of the clients, and you'll be a better therapist, I'll be a better therapist, if we are well-balanced and hopeful for our own lives, and then, therefore, we can give our clients more hope.
Absolutely. In fact, I'm glad you brought that up, because I have a chapter in my book. It's called the the Golden Principle for the Helping Professions. And basically says, don't expect others to do what you already haven't done.
That's very good.
And the point of it is that a therapist, for them to be truly effective, they have to have made progress and resolved the very same issues that they want others to resolve. You can't help someone what you can't see in yourself. So if we connect that to what you talked about with hope, when a therapist who's walked the journey, who's walked the walk and is talking the talk, can let the client know, both by direct conversation, you know, there is hope and I believe in you, and indirect by your confidence and your zeal and your positive energy, that gives a client for the very first time hope that this pain, this agony, that this relationship with a narcissist that is like beating them down physically, emotionally, and psychologically, it brings hope. And that is the magic that starts the therapy process.
It really does. And of course, true narcissists are not self-aware. So if you've got a narcissist and a codependent in your office, you've got a lot of work to do. And your book is really helpful. But true narcissists, they don't seem to have the empathy or the self-awareness. And of course, they come out of families where usually the parent wasn't so nurturing and didn't show much empathy and didn't have much high self-esteem or self-awareness.
Yeah, actually even worse than that. True narcissists, during their earliest stages of development, during their formative years, were damaged very badly because of either abuse, neglect, or deprivation.
And so
they are so damaged psychologically that by the time they become adults and start to have relationships, they have no consciousness or ability to know the harm that they're causing others. And it's a harsh word to use, and sometimes I regret using it, but it's as if that part of their mind, that part of their psychological functioning is broken. They can't actually see or understand.
You're right.
And if you can't see or understand a problem and you constantly blame others for the problem, there's really nothing that a therapist can do, because you're working with someone who doesn't have insight or judgment into the very problem that's causing pain to the partner.
Precisely. And, of course, I use attachment theory in my in my approach to clients, and you're probably familiar with attachment theory.
Oh, absolutely. In fact, a lot of my work, both from my training, therapy work, and my writing, is connected to the idea that and I call this in my book our relationship template. Depending on how we attach to our caregivers, if we had healthy and predictable attachment, we would see the world as a healthy, safe, and predictable place within which we would have healthy relationships. And that early attachment guides us in our adult relationships. But if we do not get the love, attention, or care, or attachment, we replicate that early childhood environment of in the relationships that we seek as an adult. So if you're a child who didn't attach with their mom, say you had a narcissistic mother, and you found that the only way that you could get love is by pleasing your parents.
Oh, yes.
By being the trophy child. Well, you learn that attachment is based upon what you do, a human doing. And if you are a child who did not get love, who could not figure out a way to be loved, that child suffered a damage far worse than the child that's going to be a codependent. And that attachment style of take care of yourself because no one is going to take care of you plays out in your adult relationship template.
And then you have the added problem. If you've got a mother who's a true narcissist, mm-hmm. if the child doesn't perform or behave as expected, there is this the Freudian idea of the narcissistic wound. So it's so much deeper and more devastating for the narcissistic parent.
Oh, absolutely. In fact, narcissistic wounds, or sometimes we call them narcissistic injuries, are a very curious phenomenon. Because mm-hmm. when we confront a narcissist and give them constructive feedback, which is meant to be positive, or we criticize them and we say, you burnt, you know, our steak and, you know we like mm-hmm. it medium rare. The narcissist does not see it as feedback from which they can derive some kind of benefit. They react as if you are wounding them in the same way as they were as a child. But they can't recognize that, and they tack back. So the narcissist actually is very shame-filled and very fragile. And they don't know that, but you experience that through their narcissistic injury. You confront a narcissist, give them feedback or criticism, they will attack you, not because they think they're better than you, but deep inside unconsciously, they feel so bad about themselves, they have to beat you down in order to feel better about themselves.
In order to feel better about themselves. And the other thing that happens is when traumatic experiences like we've been touching on, mm-hmm. they'll short-circuit the delicate process of empathic development when the child is a kid, right?
Yeah,
and individuals then become locked in patterns of even grandiosity and emotional disconnection.
Right.
Yeah.
And sadly, mm-hmm. as the saying goes, the apple doesn't fall far from the tree.
Yes, yes.
And I came up with an updated version of that. And mm-hmm. I say the apple doesn't fall far from the tree. And it's for us to find out upon what side of the tree do you fall. Do you fall to the codependent side, like one of your parents? Or do you, because let's assume, because of human magnet syndrome, that codependent mm-hmm. connected to the narcissist, if you have a two-parent family, one and one's a narcissist, it's very obvious that the other's going to be a codependent. So depending on your attachment or what happened and how you survived your childhood, mm-hmm. you're going to come out of childhood either set with a relationship template to be a codependent or a narcissist.
Mm. So this is a pretty good segue into your new training seminar.
Oh, yeah.
And you say this is the foundation for your second book. And I really like it that you report that you want to help codependents rather than teaching them about why they have their problems. Help them, because codependents need help. So do narcissists, but sometimes codependents are more available for the help than narcissists.
Well, because
they have a little more empathy. Well, they're people pleasers often, and that sort of thing.
But actually, the codependents can be helped because psychologically, they don't carry the same degree of trauma and psychological damage. So they are actually able to understand what's wrong with them and able
to
feel bad about it and able to, like, decide
uh-huh.
to get better. Some don't.
Uh-huh.
And that is why I specialize in working with codependents or trauma survivors, and because I've come to understand that trauma,
mm-hmm.
addictions, and codependency are intertwined.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And my second book really is an answer to the first book. The first book is what I call the why book.
Mm-hmm,
it explains...
Mm-hmm.
The second book is the how-to. Now that we know about the human magnet syndrome, what do we do about it? How does that
mm-hmm.
work? And I try to, in my seminar, which I sell on my website and will be turning it into a book, explain...
But let's mention the website. I'll put it into my summary of today's show, but go ahead. And
TheHumanMagnetSyndrome.com. HumanMagnetSyndrome.com.
Right.
And in this seminar, I actually am explaining techniques and ideas and approaches to break free from these destructive and repetitive patterns. And I do it in a way that is intuitively intuitive, and it resonates with my readers or my or the seminar participants, much like mm-hmm. my first book.
Mm-hmm. So the how-to, you're going to help it with steps and with handouts and with your book.
Oh, absolutely.
Books number one and two help people. For instance, I'm thinking a lot of people who are codependent have an external locus of control rather than an internal mm-hmm. locus of control. Could you expand on that a bit, Ross?
It's a concept that I'm vaguely familiar with, so I'll take a stab at it.
Mm-hmm.
But codependents tend to put the responsibility on others to make changes because they feel so powerless
mm-hmm.
about their lives and the circumstances that befall them. And so they don't realize their own power. So that would be the external locus of control.
Mm-hmm.
The recovering codependent who has done a lot of work in dealing with the underlying trauma, addiction, and codependency develops higher self-esteem, a more full-ranged self-concept, and starts to understand that they have the abilities and the capabilities to solve their own problems, and they feel a sense of personal efficacy. And that's what we call internal locus of control.
That's right.
And that's where psychotherapy is so important to the codependency recovery process.
Yes, and that's why it's important too for the therapist to be reasonably together and present, having done his or her own work.
Absolutely.
There was a big study done in the UK,
mm-hmm.
some 5,000. People, of course, with the internet, we can do this. And so happier living was based on, most of all, self-acceptance.
Mm-hmm.
That people that are happy and satisfied overall with life, they tend to self-accept. Mm-hmm. And there are some positive actions that increase self-acceptance, and I suspect you teach this. Oh, I know you teach it because I've seen some of your YouTube things. And tell people, before I go on a little bit about this, tell mm-hmm. people how they might view some of, they can go to your website, but how they can see you on YouTube.
You know, what I decided is that, you know, as much as, you know, I have a business and I work, I wanted to provide this information to a larger audience, an international
mm-hmm.
audience.
Mm-hmm.
So I have up to 60 videos, excerpts of my seminars or my own personal video blogs that
mm-hmm.
explain much of the content that's in my books and in my seminars. And that YouTube channel can be found under my name, Ross Rosenberg. And mm-hmm. I am blessed, man, am I lucky, because it's almost up to 700,000 views now.
Oh, that's great, Ross. Congratulations.
Yeah, that's really cool. I didn't expect, and I actually had a few people contact me a week ago, one of which translated some of my videos to Spanish and another to Russian. So that's very gratifying to know that the word has gotten out so far.
Well, obviously there's a need, isn't there?
You know what? I think it's a universal phenomenon, and that is why so many people like my book, and it's become a bestseller, is because it puts into words in a simple, intuitive way why we painfully repeat patterns despite not wanting to.
Mm-hmm.
And you can't solve a problem if you don't know about it. And
you've got to have that awareness first.
Absolutely. You can have the best therapist in the world who's the smartest therapist in the world, but if they can't understand or they don't understand the problem, they're going to lead you down a path that ultimately is not going to help, in my opinion.
Exactly. Exactly. So just back to this study in the UK about self-acceptance.
Yeah.
So being happy, self-acceptance is the hardest for lots of people to do. And so think about positive actions that increase self-acceptance, I think it's necessary to be as kind to yourself as you are to others.
Mm-hmm.
And because, of course, a lot of codependent people are very much people pleasers, but to be kind still And to see your mistakes as opportunities to learn.
Absolutely.
Notice things you do well, however small. This helps increase self-esteem, right, which is so important. And for a lot of these folks, they also need to spend some quiet time by themselves.
Yeah.
To tune in to how they're feeling inside and try to be at peace with who they are, you know, problems and all. Do you teach some of that?
Yes, I do.
To be present, to be quiet, and
well, I mean, what you're talking about are very similar to some mindfulness techniques.
But yeah.
What you speak about is the ability to be conscious of your own needs and pursue them as important as those needs of other people. And codependents have a really hard time doing that because they never learned that it was okay or safe to love themselves. They either experience rejection, punishment, or some form of consequence. So when we work with codependents, we teach them that it is as important or more important to take care of yourself and other people. And once you truly master that, then you can love people more fully and completely. And the list that you're talking about is so crucial. The how-tos really stick. The limitation of lists, in my experience, is that they can lead and guide someone, but the foundation of psychological health has to match up with the list. And so if you have someone who is able and willing to finally accept and love themselves, then those suggestions will really take them to the highest level.
It makes sense. We're coming up to a break at the half hour, but before we go there, you talk about the capability of being intimate. Well, let's see, you don't put it quite that way, but you, in my work, I certainly see that a lot of people have a lot of trouble with intimacy. And also denying their needs. This is the codependent. Ignoring rather than risking rejection or criticism. They just ignore their needs. And haven't you experienced that? And so with the that you do, it helps people be able to be more intimate, both emotionally and physically intimate.
And that's a great point, that you can't be intimate. You can't love someone if you don't love yourself. We've all heard that.
Yeah.
And the codependent feels so invisible. And so what therapy does is it takes that invisible cloak off of them. And not only are they allowed to see themselves and recognize who they are and see themselves as humans who deserve and need to be cared for, but they also show that self to others. And that invisible cloak is part of the toxic, cancerous part of codependency. As long as you're invisible, you can't see what you need and who you are, and then people aren't going to see who you are and what you need.
So then that infers that you really do have to do the work, therapeutic work, so that you can address your needs and words or actions, maybe becoming more assertive.
Absolutely.
Because a lot of these folks have trouble with that, don't they?
Well, you know, to be assertive, what an adult codependent learned early on, that there's great risk to be assertive because they had a narcissistic parent.
Right.
We talked about narcissistic injuries.
Right.
They would make a mistake or challenge that narcissistic parent. There was a consequence to be paid. And so they learned to fly under the radar and to avoid upsetting their narcissistic parent. So this child then takes this idea, and you bring that idea into adulthood. If you're afraid of upsetting the narcissist because there's a consequence, then you're through the human magnet syndrome, you're probably going to, because in the relationship template, you're probably going to end up with a narcissist with the same distorted thought process. If there's more to gain by being quiet and staying invisible than trying to get your needs met.
Ross, you are providing so much really valuable information to this program, to the listeners at Progressive Radio Network. We're going to go to a break, and when we come back, Ross is going to give you his four stages of codependency recovery. We're going to talk also about the role of shame and loneliness in codependency, how it's connected to addiction, loneliness and codependency. Lots to talk about, and we've got the best person to talk with about this, Ross Rosenberg. Thank you, Ross. Thank you, listeners, and we'll be right back after the break. We're back. This is Dr. Diana Wiley. I'm here with Ross Rosenberg, the author of The Human Magnet Syndrome. And we're having, I think, a very interesting, and I believe it could be very helpful for lots of folks out there, talking about codependency and narcissism, which is part of that human magnet syndrome, and why we repeat our dysfunctional relationship patterns. We want to talk, Ross, now about how you manage the four stages of codependency recovery.
Sure.
With your therapy, with your trainings, because you're the director of Clinical Care Consultants, which is in Illinois, Arlington Heights.
Mm-hmm.
So, and that information will also be up on the PRN website. So, four stages of codependency recovery.
Oh, and if I could just add a little bit of
yes,
what you said,
please.
I actually own Clinical Care Consultants and
yes.
Advanced Clinical Trainers, a training company. But
mm-hmm.
as a psychotherapist
mm-hmm.
And a recovering codependent, I started to pay attention to the process of codependency recovery because I've been working with codependents my whole career,
mm-hmm.
and I started to notice that there are four discrete stages.
Mm-hmm.
But before I give you a really quick introduction to it, I want to say that on YouTube there's a whole webcast available for that talks about the four stages of codependency recovery. So where I start is I start with what I call my Surgeon General's warning. And we know that on a pack of cigarettes it says, or even a wine bottle, it says if you smoke, you're probably going to get cancer and emphysema, or if you drink while you're driving, you know, you're probably going to crash.
Mm-hmm.
And I think it's morally and ethically important to warn my codependent clients the risks that are present in becoming released from their codependency patterns or to start codependency recovery. And the four stages of codependency recovery precisely does that. Because stage one I call stage one setting boundaries. Stage one is a really, really difficult, anxiety-laden stage in which you finally, for the first time in your life, you start to set boundaries. And if you are a codependent, your primary relationships are going to consist probably with mostly people who are narcissistic, some pathologically narcissistic, and some just kind of selfish.
Mm-hmm.
And
mm-hmm.
I explained to my codependent clients that everyone's going to be mad at them. And that's mm-hmm. the Surgeon General warning. If you move forward and get healthy, you need to understand that people are going to be mad, you're going to lose friends, you're going to lose loved ones, and you're going to wish in moments of agony and fear and loneliness, you're going to wish that you really never did this. And, so stage one in setting boundaries is analogous to being an alcoholic and telling an alcoholic, if you stop drinking, you're probably going to get DTs and get very sick. So this is what you need to do to take care of yourself. And stage one is not only is there conflict and there's anxiety and fear, and it's equivalent to the earthquake in your life, you're also going to experience severe bouts of loneliness.
Yes.
And stage one lasts about 0 to 3 months. And if you hang tight and you work with a therapist and you build support networks, you're going to get to stage two, which is maintaining boundaries in a hostile environment. And I call this stage separating the wheat from the chaff. The narcissist have had all these narcissistic injuries and think that you're a bad person, and they left you because you no longer will take care of them. And so those people have kind of dumped you. And this could be actually a parent, a sibling, or your spouse. And what you're left with is a lot of people who are resentful and angry and don't understand what happened to you. All of a sudden, you went from being really nice to being selfish. Now, you have to understand that codependents who are in early recovery are accused of being selfish because of the narcissists have always relied on their care. And that's the projection.
And that's the projection.
And in stage two, they have to just hang tight and maintain the new boundaries in a hostile environment. And that lasts 3 to 6 months.
Mm-hmm.
And in stage three, building new relationships, what we find are people actually that are left in your circle of relationships, they start to get used to you. They start to accommodate to your healthy balance between taking care of yourself and others. And so the anger is gone. The people that are incensed and enraged about how you've changed are gone. And what you're doing is you're building either new relationships or you're rebuilding old relationships that are taking on the feel of new relationships.
Mm-hmm.
And that's a very exciting stage because that is when, and that happens usually from like 6 months to a year. That is mm-hmm. when the codependents finally understand that finally there's a payoff. And then stage four, which is 1 year and on, it's reinforcing and strengthening new relationships. This mm-hmm. is when you, for the first time, feel that the wonder of love and connection and mutuality and reciprocity. And,
mm-hmm.
a curious phenomenon happens in stage four, is that people that are still with you, that were with you from the beginning, will make comments to you like, you are so healthy now.
Uh-huh.
You are so, and they will forget how mad they were when you changed.
Right.
And so that is a very quick version of the four stages of codependency recovery.
And if the person can make it through the four stages,
mm-hmm.
and they get finally some recognition from some of their loved ones,
mm-hmm.
that they're healthier, that they're happier,
yes.
that they're more self-accepting.
And by that time...
And more assertive.
And so once you get to stage four, there's no going back. Because,
yes.
Because stage four is... stage one is when you plant the seeds. Stage two is when they take root. Stage three is when the roots dig deeper. And stage four is you got a tree.
Yeah, so you plant the seed in stage one. It takes root in stage two.
The roots start to hold you down. Roots stabilize you.
Uh-huh.
And in stage four, you grow into a beautiful, wonderful plant.
Right.
Healthy, strong. It's a metaphor.
Of course. No, I like it. I like it a lot. You must do really exceptional work with your clients and in your trainings.
No, I love it. I get such a passion for it. I'm always sending my wife's, some of the emails that I get where people, tell me how much they appreciate what I talk about. And, I remember being 22 and saying, when I grow up, I want to be a therapist and I want to save the world. No,
you really knew that at 22?
Oh, well, no. Every person that's a psych major knows that. The difference between someone who's actually not 22, 18 or 19 when I started.
Uh-huh.
Actually, 22. I started college when I was 22. But the difference between a psych major who gets a job, there's a point at which you go, oh, my gosh, I'm getting paid nothing. I'm being overworked. And that idealism goes out the window. But for me, I remember that idealism. And, of course, I still want to save the world, but I also, want to send my son to college. I want to be nice and generous to my wife. I want to take care of people I love and maybe go on vacation.
Sure.
But the idea
because that adds to the balance in your own life.
Absolutely.
And I'm
blessed because of that.
Of course. Yes, I feel very much the same about my work. I think it's such a blessing when you can do what you love and feel that it matters.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely.
And we're blessed that we can do this, Ross. And I never take that for granted ever. So let's talk a little bit more about why and how codependency can be an addiction.
Mm-hmm. You know, that's a concept that I've been developing over the last 4 or 5 years. And what I've noticed is, you know, we think of an addiction. We think of a repetitive pattern that we think that makes us feel good. We think we can control, but yet we find out we can't control. It ends up making us feel worse. We experience shame, and we make promises that we're not going to do it again, and then we do it again. So so the drug addict or the sex addict or the gambling addict will struggle with their drug of choice. But and I quote this, the drug of choice for the codependent is a narcissist. They believe they can control them. They believe that they're going to make them feel happy. Mm-hmm. And they experience a momentary feeling of elation and euphoria. And over and over again, they're disappointed. And they do that over and over again because there's a feeling of euphoria and safety, and paradoxically in these relationships. Just like when we talk to an alcoholic, you know, they say, well, I like drinking because it makes me feel this, makes me feel that. And the denial system is that they can't see how harmful it is. The number one withdrawal symptom of the codependent, when the codependent finally sets boundaries, they experience toxic loneliness. Every codependent who starts off and sets boundaries for the first time, they experience overwhelming loneliness. It almost has a body feel to it. And that will draw them back into relapsing and finding their self-medication, the narcissist, to take care of that loneliness. So I've come to understand that codependency parallels an addiction. And when I teach my clients that, they have something tangible and concrete to help them in the recovery process, because thankfully the 12-step program has done such a good job at providing tools and groups and concepts that have helped people go beyond their addiction.
This is very good. You've put some things together that I think are really useful. So a person, though, withdrawing, mm-hmm. a lonely person who's withdrawing from the symptom of codependency, mm-hmm. What do you think could be some really helpful things in that withdrawal other than going to the drug of choice, the narcissistic partner?
Well, if we understand codependency as an addiction, we understand the codependent is medicating some what I call an original condition or original trauma or core trauma, which is why in my trainings I call it the reversing the human magnet syndrome, codependency and trauma recovery. Mm-hmm. And the trauma the codependent carries with them is feeling meaningless and unlovable.
Yeah.
And that is a core feeling that they try really hard to not feel. The alcoholic mm-hmm. will drink, the sex addict will do whatever they do, and all addicts are trying to hide that core feeling or the original condition. So what I find that the very best way for people to truly have a lifelong sustained recovery, mm-hmm. that's recovery, is to understand what caused them to become codependent. What were the conditions? And we find that they were traumatized. They were abused. They were neglected. They were mm-hmm. deprived. And that is why in my therapy and in my trainings, codependency recovery requires psychotherapy work with someone who understands that to recover from codependency and to overcome it, you have to not only work on the problem itself, but dig deeper and get to the problem. The original problem, because codependency actually is a symptom of a much deeper problem.
Of course it is. Of course it is. And so these folks had the opposite of secure attachment.
Exactly.
They often had anxious attachment or avoidant attachment. They were neglected.
Mm-hmm.
So were narcissists often.
Sure.
A parent is overly involved in participating in a child's feelings rather than reflecting them, maybe even rushing in to rescue a child from an unpleasant feeling before he's been able to identify it, for instance. The child can failed to develop regulatory control of his emotions.
Mm-hmm.
I think that happens with narcissists and with codependents.
Yes, I would agree. Yes,
so
that's true.
The other thing about getting better as a person, as an adult, is if you're a parent, hopefully you do this before you have children, but you know, you may be able to correct some actions, some courses, so that your children will grow up with secure attachment. And when you have secure attachment, your adult relationships are much more likely to be healthy, where, you know, you have somebody who is available and responsive to your needs when you have them, when you have conflict or whatever.
Yeah, and I'm glad that you bring that up because because it is possible for you to reverse the attachment deficit of your childhood into as an adult to like heal those wounds and to change your relational destiny.
Yes. I bet you wished you'd had some of that in your first two marriages.
I wish I had that in my childhood.
In your childhood, yes.
Yeah, and I talk about this in my book. I talk about the origins of codependency and origins of narcissism, and I also share my story, is that, you know, we replicate the very conditions that were so harmful to us in our childhood, because in an odd way, in an unconscious way, it's familiar. And
that's
codependents,
right.
Codependents know what to do with narcissists. They feel lost and unsafe with healthy people. It's actually an odd phenomenon.
Mm-hmm. Well, it is odd. I have a rather scatological metaphor here, but but it is this. You know, the room may smell like shit, but we're familiar with the smell.
Exactly.
So it's very important to become who you're meant to become, I think, so that you attract another healthy partner.
Right. You know, there's a saying that it's one of my favorite sayings. I have it on my wall in my counseling center.
Yeah.
I have it on my website, and it's by George Eliot. It's never too late to be the person you should have been.
Oh, I like that. Yeah.
And that's the hope that I try to instill with all my clients, that it's whether you're 40, 60, 70, it's still possible to be what your parents could not, for whatever reason, teach you to be.
So it's never too late to become
the person you were meant to be.
Yeah, to become the person you were meant to be.
Now, I constantly mess up quotes, but it's basically like that. My wife is great at telling me how she likes to tease me in that way.
Well, it sounds like you have a healthy, playful relationship, and that's great if she can tease you. I have that with my fiance Brian, that you know, we tease each other, we poke fun at each other. But because there's so much trust and love and healthiness, you know, it's accepted and valued.
Yeah.
I'm thinking about Eric Byrne and his the parent, the adult, and the child ego states. Remember this from your early training?
Oh, my gosh. Eric Byrne goes back to, like,
the late 60s.
Oh, yeah. I think I don't want to date myself, but I wasn't thinking about psychological theory in the late 60s. I was thinking about...
Well, you were probably very young. I'm a bit older than you, but
I'm
reading about him.
And thank you. I'm not.
And thinking, oh, this makes sense. But then I revisited it, and it's really true. Like, when you're doing therapy with clients, ideally, you're in your adult ego state. You're in the moment sharing information.
Mm-hmm.
So then you go to the parent ego state, and either you have the critical parent or the nurturing parent. The critical parent ego state is like, you should be doing it this way, you ought to be doing it this way, blah, blah, blah. And nurturing parent is when you're actually taking care of somebody who's sick, or you just feel you're empathic. You're
right.
And then the child ego state, so the adult is in the middle, the parent is in the top, the child is at the bottom, sort of the id in terms of Freudian, right?
Mm-hmm.
So the child ego state is either the rebellious child who has his or her arms crossed in front and saying, well, fuck you, I will not do that, and the stubborn, or the playful child. And I tell my clients that ideally they need to be in their playful child when they're having sex, when they're making love,
mm-hmm.
that there's not necessarily a beginning, a middle, and an end to sex, that you just play and you have fun and you laugh and you're silly. And but the hardest ego state to deal with, and it's often the most entrenched, is the critical parent.
Mm-hmm.
So some people will drink alcohol or take drugs or whatever to put that critical parent to sleep so that the child can come out to play.
Right. And you know what, and that sometimes is a challenge because we bring that critical parent from one generation to another.
Absolutely.
We promise ourselves that we're not going to be like our parents, but so often we actually end up emulating them without even knowing.
Right. There are our models.
Mm-hmm. Both for good and bad.
Sure. Sure. But then if you can be good models for your children and you play, I remember Masters and Johnson, William Masters, Dr. Masters, saying that the best sex education you could give your kid is to see the father coming up behind the mother while maybe she's cooking at the stove and grabbing her butt and giving her a hug from behind. Nothing terribly overt, but just affectionate.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely, because what you're doing is you're modeling to the children what love looks like. I mean, we can talk all day about love and what, you know, but we learn by not only what it looks like in our own private world, especially as children, but also more than that is how love is delivered or not delivered to you, or how you are loved or not loved.
Ross, you know, once again, you have been just an incredibly wonderful guest with so much to offer our listeners, and I'm going to write this up, and we'll put an image of your book, The Human Magnet Syndrome, up on the PRN website. It'll also be on my website, drdianawiley.com, and I imagine you'll get it up somewhere or another on your website eventually.
Sure.
Because usually these show, PRN, wonderful PRN people, archive it pretty quickly after the show is over.
Mm-hmm.
And lots of people do listen to the archive version. So thank you so much, Ross. Another wonderful program with you.
Well, thank you. And it's a pleasure to be on your show. I love being on it, and I love talking with you because you're just such a charming and knowledgeable clinician and radio personality.
Oh, thanks. You're a sweetheart. And next week, so thanks again, Ross. So next week I'll have Joan Price. She is the author of Better Than I Ever Expected. It's about senior sexuality, and she has a new book, Senior Erotica. So a little change of pace, but that's what we'll do next week. So tune in. Thanks again, Ross.
Oh, thank you.
Bye, everybody.
Bye-bye. Cosa leggerai?